Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Death Row Inmates in Substitution of Counsel Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On December 6, 2011, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Martel v. Clare. The question in this case is whether state prisoner on death row is entitled to replace his court-appointed attorney with a new court-appointed attorney on the grounds that, according to the prisoner, the first court-appointed attorney failed to pursue potentially important evidence relating to the prisoner's case. To discuss the case, we have Ronald Eisenberg, who is the Deputy District Attorney for the Law Division at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Mr. Eisenberg.
Martel v. Clare is yet another instance in which the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has used federal habeas corpus law to jeopardize a long-ago California capital murder conviction. The twist here, though, is that, unlike many other Ninth Circuit rulings that have recently attracted the attention of the United States Supreme Court, this conviction has not yet been outright reversed. Instead, the Ninth Circuit essentially allowed the defendant, Kenneth Clare, to restart his habeas litigation from scratch after 17 years in federal court and 26 years after the murder, because Clare decided that he was no longer happy with the team of habeas lawyers appointed to defend him. The Supreme Court granted review to determine the standard to be applied in deciding a defendant's request to replace appointed federal habeas counsel. After oral argument on December 6th, it looks like the case may not generate a general rule for resolving such motions. The story traces back to what Clare did in the year 1984. At the time, he was occupying a vacant house in Santa Ana, California. After he burglarized a nearby home, the owners reported him to the police. He was arrested and briefly jailed. The night he got out, he determined to victimize the same neighbors. He headed to their house with his girlfriend, but left her down the street. The neighbors, it turned out, were not at home, but their 25-year-old babysitter was, along with five young children. Clare tied up the babysitter with her hands behind her back. He beat her repeatedly in the head, sexually assaulted her, and strangled her to death. Before leaving, he took jewelry and other items from the home. Then he met up again with his girlfriend. The girlfriend noticed blood on his hand and asked him about it. He admitted that he had been, quote, beating up a woman. Later, when she was eventually questioned by the police, the girlfriend described some of the objects that she saw Clare carrying after the murder. They matched items that were missing from the home. Clare's girlfriend agreed to wear a hidden microphone and secretly record a conversation with him. On the recording, she told Clare that police had been asking about the stolen jewelry. He explained that that was why he hadn't given her any of the jewelry, and that he had since thrown it away. He assured her that there was nothing to worry about because no one had seen him go in or out of the house, and he had not left any fingerprints. When she expressed concern about the gravity of what he had done, murdering a girl, Clare, annoyed, told her to stop rubbing it in his face. Clare was convicted by a jury in 1987 and was sentenced to death. He had a full appeal to the California Supreme Court, which affirmed the sentence. In 1993, he began federal habeas corpus proceedings. After appointment of counsel and extensive discovery, Clare received an evidentiary hearing, called numerous witnesses, and filed post-hearing briefs. By now, it was 2005, 21 years after the murder. Clare sent the court a letter complaining that his lawyers were not trying hard enough to get him off. The court declined to replace counsel on this basis. Clare wrote again a few months later, complaining that his lawyers had not sought DNA and fingerprint testing of crime scene evidence. The district court again declined to replace counsel. After reviewing all of the preceding 12 years of proceedings, the court then denied habeas relief, concluding that all of Clare's claims were meritless. Clare filed a motion for further review under Federal Rule 60B, and a motion for permission to file a second habeas petition. He alleged that another similar murder had been committed near the time and place of his crime. he asserted that DNA and fingerprint testing in his case could prove his innocence if, by some one-in-a-million chance, the testing matched the other perpetrator, who was now conveniently deceased. He failed to explain, however, how his new claim of innocence could be reconciled with the blood on his hands immediately after the crime, with his own prompt admission that he had beaten a woman, or with his own recorded statement, bragging that he had been smart enough to get rid of the stolen goods and to leave no fingerprints behind. Unsuccessful in federal district court, Clare filed multiple appeals to the Ninth Circuit. The panel, though, declined to resolve any of them. Rather than determine whether the habeas petition had been properly denied, whether the Rule 60B motion had been properly rejected, or whether Clare could properly file a new successive habeas petition, the Court of Appeals instead focused on the letters Clare had sent the district judge on the eve of the decision below, in which he demanded new appointed counsel. The Court of Appeals reasoned that because federal law mandated appointment of counsel for state capital defendants on federal habeas review, defendants were implicitly entitled to, quote, meaningful assistance. A request for new counsel should be granted where appropriate, quote, in the interests of justice. In this case, held the Court of Appeals, the district court had not adequately considered these interests. Accordingly, the panel vacated the judgment below, appointed new counsel retroactively, and authorized him to amend the habeas petition as if it were just being filed now. The panel in question consisted of Judge Wardlaw, Judge Pragerson, and Judge Reinhardt. The Supreme Court granted the state's petition for a writ of certiorari. In its merits brief, the state argued that the standard applied by the Ninth Circuit was too squishy. The state pointed out that under federal law, a defendant is not entitled to relief on the ground that his appointed habeas lawyer provided ineffective assistance of counsel under Strickland versus Washington. Therefore, contended the state, the defendant should be entitled to replacement of habeas counsel only if he can make a showing that he was effectively denied counsel altogether, a higher standard, akin to the holding of United States versus Cronic. The state urged that under the loose approach taken by the Ninth Circuit, a request for new appointed counsel could swallow up substantive standards of review and allow a court to circumvent statutory provisions limiting the timing or the number of habeas petitions by granting a defendant a new lawyer and giving him a do-over that would otherwise have been prohibited. Clare's brief responded that the case was really much ado about nothing. Clare noted that the federal appointment statute for capital defendants, 18 U.S.C. 3599, doesn't contain any language setting forth a standard for replacement of counsel. Clare argued that the court should view Section 3599 as in pari materia with another statute, 18 U.S.C. 3006, which governs appointment of counsel generally in federal criminal cases. That statute does refer to the interests of justice. Clare maintained, therefore, that the Ninth Circuit didn't overreach here and actually did very little, since it did not technically decide the merits of Clare's appeals and instead merely remanded for further proceedings. At oral argument, most members of the Supreme Court seemed disinclined to explore precise differences between the standards advocated by the state and by Clare. Instead, more attention was paid to the question of whether the Ninth Circuit acted properly under any circumstances, however a standard is defined. After more than a decade of supervising the case, after all, the district judge was quite familiar with Clare, with his counsel, and with his legal claims. In that situation, shouldn't the judge have discretion to dismiss a defendant's pro se complaint about his lawyers without convening some kind of formal inquisition? If, as Justice Alito noted, the standard is as open-ended as Clare contends it is, then it is the district court that should be accorded broad leeway, not the appellate court. Justice Sotomayor pointed out that there may be times when the shoe is on the other foot, when it is the state that would wish the judge discretion to replace counsel. Suppose, for example, that the defendant wants to waive his appeals and allow his execution to go forward, but his appointed lawyers refuse to cooperate. Chief Justice Roberts, meanwhile, offered a scenario illustrating the dangers of a more permissive standard. Suppose that a week before oral argument of this case in the Supreme Court, the defendant had filed a motion seeking to replace his appointed Supreme Court attorney on the ground that counsel was not presenting the right arguments. Would counsel have to defend himself? Would the Supreme Court have to conduct an inquiry on the matter? In the end, Clare's counsel conceded that, quote, "We're not really arguing about the standard one way or the other." His position seemed to come down to the contention that this was a rare case in which a change of counsel was compelled by a concern about the handling of Clare's new actual innocence claim. But the actual innocence claim doesn't appear to be particularly compelling here at all. It seems possible, therefore, that the court will reverse the Ninth Circuit on the facts of this particular case, without having to decide on the wording of a standard for resolving requests to replace habeas corpus counsel. Indeed, even if the court were to adopt an interest of justice standard, that vague language would not tell us very much, as Justice Kennedy observed. And as the state argued, the phrase has no fixed meaning and may vary by context anyway. But one issue does remain troubling. The inescapable fact is that Clare's last-minute motion for new counsel did succeed in allowing him to begin relitigation of his habeas petition. Clare's current protests to the contrary, the truth is that the Ninth Circuit didn't just remand for further inquiry on the counsel question. It explicitly turned back the clock and ordered the district court to consider requests to rewrite the habeas petition as if it had never been denied. If the standard is lax enough to allow a habeas court, whether district or appellate, to indulge such a result, then habeas petitioners will be sure to file motions to replace counsel rather than shoulder the heavier burden of surmounting limitations on untimely amendments or successive petitions. And sooner or later, in this case or another, the court will be facing the issue again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. For more episodes of SCOTUS Cast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.